And now it's my delight and my privilege to introduce Dr. Yoram Inspector. He was trained in medicine at the Ben Gurion and Tel Aviv universities in Israel, and then completed his 6 years of psychiatric training at the Shalvata Mental Health Center in Israel, which is affiliated to the Sattva Faculty of Medicine at the Tel Aviv University. His medical doctorate researched the psychiatric aspects of heart transplantation. He is actually multi-talented. He's a consultant psychiatrist, psychotherapist, Jungian analyst, a member of the International Association of Analytical Psychology, and the New Israeli Jungian Society, and now a post-trainee at the Society of Analytical Psychology in London. He specialised in eating disorders psychiatry and currently heads the Psychological Medicine Unit of St Mark's Hospital in London, which provides psychotherapy to patients who suffer gastroenterological disorders. He is a great believer in the healing powers, the common sense, and the sense of humour. So we say to Dr. Inspector, you're very welcome to the gift.
Thank you very much. I'm privileged and honored to be here. And listening to this wonderful poetry, I feel I want to start with something very personal that it evoked. My father, who died after he broke his hip at a good age of 87, but it's always too soon, on his last days, he was quite confused. He suddenly asked a woman that was a wife of the other patient in the room, what's the most important thing for you in life? She didn't know what this man asks her and what it's all about, and she said, I really don't know. So he said to her, if you don't know, maybe you can ask me what's the most important thing in life. And she asked him, and to my surprise, and not to my surprise, he said, poetry. Poetry is the most important thing in the world. And it reminds me what Yehuda Amichai, the Israeli poet that I had the privilege to interview once, when I asked him what's the role of poetry, he said the role of poetry is to bring back words their original power. So we use words all the time, but poetry brings back words their original power. And this is actually how I personally feel about Jungian psychology. I think it brings back the psyche its original power, and the power that is being corroded by all the professional words that we use all the time. I brought quite a lot of images and tried to really bring the original power of the psychosomatic matrix web junction, which I find myself working in on a daily basis. I would like to start with a quote from Jung about the psychosomatic field from Collective Work 8, The Structure and the Dynamics of the Psyche. And Jung said, we cannot rid ourselves of the doubt that perhaps the whole separation of mind and body may finally prove to be merely a device of reason for the purpose of conscious discrimination, an intellectually necessary separation of one and the same fact into two aspects, to which we then illegitimately attribute an independent existence. So I think it's a key thing that I think Jung noted, that it's actually one and the same thing, the body and the psyche. Something I found myself demonstrating it with is a classic Jewish joke, and all the Jewish jokes starts with two Jews meet, and then there are endless variations on it. And the joke is about two Jews that meet, and one holds two heavy suitcases in his hands, and the other is without the suitcases. So the guy without the suitcases asked the guy with the suitcases, can you direct me from here to Regent Street? So the guy with the suitcases says, from here to Regent Street? You know, can you hold the suitcases for me for a second? So he said, why to hold the suitcases? They're very heavy and I'm a small man. I want just directions. He says, you want me to direct you? Hold the suitcases. So he gives him the suitcases, and then the man is freed from his suitcases and he says, from here to Regent Street? I don't know where it is. So you cannot do that with the suitcases. But actually, if you think about it, in terms of separation of body and mind, this is demonstration. We feel this embarrassment, this discomfort, and there needs to be a sort of a bodily discharge. So it's actually one unit with different languages, but the holistic view is, I think, a core thing in the Jungian approach. So why does it create so much trouble, this whole thing of body and mind? There is one creature that actually doesn't suffer from it. This creature is something that is called a sea squirt. So the sea squirt, you know, looks like sort of a squid. They're quite beautiful. They sit on a rock. They look like plants, but actually they are living creatures. Not that plants are not living creatures, but this creature has a little heart, stomach, gonads, a primitive lung. So it's, you know, but it doesn't have a brain. It used to have a brain. So this creature had a brain that helped them to allocate the best rock to settle on, temperature-wise, predator-wise. Once they zoom in on the rock that they sit on and they allocate themselves on the rock, they eat their own brain, because they don't need it anymore. So actually, if you don't need to move, you don't need a brain. And this led the biologists that researched these creatures to come with a statement that the most important part of the role of the brain is actually not to think, but to make the body move. And actually the brain moves everything. And when I went to a workshop of Basil van der Kolk, who is the leading authority on trauma, I think from Harvard University, wrote the book called The Body Keeps the Score, he started the workshop with this sentence exactly and said that actually what all traumatic experiences share is not being able to move. So psychologically, physically, being held down, not being able to move. And this is a key aspect, I think, of the body trauma, the psyche, and the mind. And a movement can be also dreaming, an internal movement of something. But when we are not allowed to move, to express, to think, we are traumatized. So because we have a brain that keeps us moving, we have more troubles than the sea squirt. So working at St. Mark's Hospital, which is a gastroenterological hospital, I find myself giving these strange lectures, like what the psyche has to do with inflammatory bowel diseases, Crohn's and colitis, and we won't get into the neuroscience of that, but I find myself doing these juxtapositions of Psyche, who was a princess with butterfly wings, and the inflamed colon in ulcerative colitis. But actually, if you think about Psyche with butterfly wings, we always say that we feel butterflies in our stomach. So actually, we feel Psyche in our stomach. But it's this juxtaposition of something that is very airy, delicate, with the visceral presence of the body, that it's hard for us to grasp. Another variation, the brain-gut axis. And interestingly, the brain, I think, if you think about an organ that is most similar to the brain visually, is maybe the small intestine. You know, see the similarity. So in modern science, we speak about the brain-gut axis, but actually our ancestors knew it thousands and thousands of years ago. The image that I loved in order to demonstrate the body mind connection or the brain gut connection is this face. Don't know if you know who he is. He is called Humbaba. And Humbaba appears in the myth of Gilgamesh. The myth of Gilgamesh is the oldest story known to man that was found on stones in the area of Mesopotamia. And he's the guardian of the holy cedar forest. And you can see very clearly here his intestine on his face. You can say actually that all his face is a sort of a labyrinth-like intestine. But for me, it's one of the oldest ancient reminders that it's one unit. And this mask that you can find actually in the British Museum grasps it. So the story of Gilgamesh, if you haven't read it, speaks about Gilgamesh and Enkidu. It starts with Gilgamesh, who was the ruler of Uruk, was a beautiful city, and he was, the story tells us, two-thirds divine and one-third animalistic. So he was handsome, almighty, all-powerful, but extremely arrogant and, in modern terms, narcissistic. He did whatever he wanted with the people of Uruk. All the virgins had to spend the first night of the marriage with him. The people couldn't stand him, and they wanted to pray to the gods to humiliate him and to humble him and to change his attitude. So the gods take it seriously and decide on a plan how to actually transform him. So they make him meet a creature who is called Enkidu, who interestingly is two-thirds animalistic and one-third divine. So it's quite amazing that at that time, I think it's 1,000 years before the Odyssey of Homer, the people were busy with trying to find the balance between the mind and the body. And they become very good friends, and then decide like two macho men to kill a monster just for the sake of overcoming something difficult. And they choose to kill Humbaba. And they shouldn't kill Humbaba, and Humbaba is the guardian of the holy cedar forest. And after they kill him, Enkidu starts to die. And the whole story is a very in-depth meditation about the inability to stop mortality. And this is what actually transforms a Gilgamesh, who understands that he's not almighty, and it's a whole long process of mourning to understand that he's also mortal. It's actually a very deep, beautiful meditation on mortality and transience and accepting it. So here is Enkidu and Gilgamesh killing Humbaba. And obviously, if he's the intestine, or you shouldn't do it. And it led me to something that my patient said in St. Mark's after he had a colectomy. He said, losing my colon felt like losing part of my mind. So actually, you can say that he suffered from ulcerative colitis for a long time, so his mind was very much invested in it, and suddenly he doesn't have it, so part of his mind that was invested in it went away. But actually, we feel so much in our intestine that actually when we lose part of it, something of our feeling of our mind goes away. So in the last 6 years, I found myself in this strange field that I called psychogastroenterology. So not only I don't know always what I'm doing there, also the GPs that refer to me don't know how to address me. So I receive letters like that to Dr. Inspector, gut psychiatrist. this is actually serious because actually it demonstrates the split in medicine between the body and the mind, because actually we don't treat a gut. The gut, as far as we know, doesn't have psychiatric problems. It's the person with the gut who has the problems. Or because of my strange name, which is actually my true name, Inspector, probably one of the ancestors in Poland was either an inspector of police or an inspector for kosher food, probably. My first role in my children's pantomime here was Inspector Clouseau in Aladdin. Won't go into this. But I received letters like that. Dr. Yoram, Inspector Psychiatrist for IBS. Which is Irritable Bowel Syndrome. But it just shows you how difficult it is to bridge these two things. So actually, this is another demonstration to the difficulty in conceptualizing body and mind, and going back to Jung, that it's two sides of the same thing. So either you see the vase or you see the faces, but it's actually the same thing. So the thing is with the psychosoma problem is that in a way it's unsolvable because the body is described in quantitative language, more hormones, more blood, and the psyche is defined in qualitative terms. So like on the CD, if they'll show me the digital representation of the Bach in C, the mass of Bach, and what I'll see is just 010101. It is the same mass, but obviously it doesn't say anything because I experience things through symbols, through senses. So if somebody tells me, oh, this man has not enough serotonin, it doesn't say to me anything about their experience of their depression. Yet these are two sides of the same thing. So this black and white image led me associatively to this image that I won't tell you straight away what it is, but just to ask you, what do you think it is? I won't analyze your answers, don't worry. A fish, yeah. Any other ideas? Ripping a curtain. Ripping a curtain, yeah. A cat's eye. Yeah. So I saw this picture in a gallery in Manchester. So I went to do a course in actually quite a short term, one of the rare soulful short term therapies that were actually developed according to the book of Bob Hobson, who was a Jungian analyst, working with functional gut disorders. So actually, you meet the person, and the first session is up to 3 hours. So you give all the time in the world to the person to unfold the problem. So for example, a patient comes with IBS, and then she speaks about everything, and you wait patiently, like a fisherman, to a metaphor that will come. And these are patients that actually all the physical problems have been ruled out. Not a physical problem, but that there isn't a major other thing, and it stays in the realm of a functional gut disorder or IBS. And then she says the most disturbing thing is actually the trapped air. And then she says that she goes home on the tube and she feels very trapped there. And then she comes home and she feels trapped in her room, and then the word trapped keeps coming back, and she tells me that she works in a big room and she feels trapped there because she cannot go out because she's bloated and she's afraid that people will look at her. And this is what you wait for. And I say, actually, I hear that the word trapped keeps repeating so much. And she said immediately, yes, I don't want to be trapped like my mother in unsuccessful marriage, and I don't know what to do with my partner. And yeah. So suddenly you have this arc from the trapped air to trapped in relationship. And so anyhow, just this is in brackets. So I did this course there, and facing the university, there was a gallery. I forgot the name of the gallery, quite a famous gallery in Manchester, and they had an exhibition on black and white in art. And there were all sorts of very good works of Van Gogh and Picasso, English painters on black and white. And suddenly I see this, and I was really drawn to it because the black was very rich. For me, my association was a candle in the wind, a candle in the dark, the light at the end of the tunnel. And I come closer and I see that this is a work by Anthony Gormley, the sculptor who did The Angel of the North, another combination of the spiritual and the earth. And it's from a series of works entitled Body and Soul. And actually, it somehow fitted. And then I go closer and see the specific title of this work. And this work is entitled Asshole. So actually, this is the title. Actually, this is the asshole of Anthony Gormley. So what he did, he imprinted parts of his body on paper. And this is a print. So actually, if you're chronically constipated, this is really the light at the end of the tunnel. But I was so moved by this because it brought back the asshole, its spiritual significance. This organ became a curse. But actually, without this organ, we would be dead. Also, Professor Phillips, who is the medical director of St. Mark's and is a colorectal surgeon, and deals with this area a lot, and he says, try to put feces, air, and water in your hand and try carefully open it and let only the water come out or the air come out alone. You cannot do it, no? But your asshole can. You know, because he has these two sophisticated sphincters, the external sphincter that is connected to our will, voluntary, the internal sphincter that is connected to the autonomic nervous system. It's an extremely delicate thing. So, suggest to people, next time somebody tells you that you're an asshole, tell them, thank you very much. It means that I'm hugely important. But this is actually, I'm laughing, but this is a very serious thing because it actually brings this whole area, like I said before, it's a spiritual importance, and a lot of my work is redeeming, trying to redeem ourselves, myself, my patients, from the taboo around this area, because there's so much shame, so much embarrassment, and so many social phobias and all sorts of problems that are created because of this. And it brought me back to my tribe and to this wonderful prayer that the Orthodox Jew needs to say every time after defecation and urination, which is called Asher Yatzar, he who created, or some people call it just the bathroom prayer. And this is the prayer. So after defecation, you need to say, blessed are you, Hashem, our God, King of the universe, who formed man with wisdom and created within him many openings and many hollows, cavities. It is obvious and known before your throne of glory that if one of them were to be ruptured or if one of them to be blocked, it would be impossible to survive and stand before you, I like the brackets, even for a short period of time. Blessed are you, Hashem, who heals all flesh and acts wondrously. So actually, to make this thing holy. Some people say that this is holy shit, actually. I think this is important, and for me it's another example of the unity of body and mind, of soul and body. So now, after this introduction more to the clinical work, and I actually, after all these studies of all the psychological theories, and my first school in psychotherapy in Israel was more psychodynamic in oriented psychotherapy, and I was very interested in the work of Heinz Kohut and self-psychology. Then I did the switch to Jung, and then, you know, in the Jungian world you have the archetypal approach, the classical approach, the developmental approach. You know, sometimes I feel, you all know the joke about the two Jews and the three synagogues, you know? So for the people who don't know, somebody comes to this island and there are two Jews and there are three synagogues there. So the visitor asks them, they're very nice, these synagogues, but you are just two Jews, why do you need three synagogues? So one guy says, listen, to this synagogue I go, to the other synagogue my friend goes, and to the third one, none of us will never ever go. So sometimes with all these synagogues in the Jungian world, it feels a bit like that. But I'm now in a phase where I think this is what it's all about. Just to be the second mouse. But this needs a bit of explanation, I guess. So this is based on an experiment that was done with mice, and we share 90% of our gene with mice, actually 99% with a chimpanzee and 50% with a banana. I know what Freud would made of it, but we are Jungians, I guess. Yeah. So the experiment was done by Henri Lebory, who is a psychiatrist, who actually invented the chlorpromazine, and he wrote a book called L'éloge de la fuite, The Privilege to Escape, where he speaks about escaping as a legitimate survival mode. We generally condemn it, but he said, no, sometimes, you know, it's a good idea. You know, I wouldn't be sitting here if my father wouldn't escape from the Nazis. So, but to be the second mouse is based on this experiment that he did. He took a mouse, he put him in a cage, he gave him an electrical shock that is disturbing but not dangerous. The door of the cage was open, the mouse escapes, nothing happened to him. So if you can escape, you're fine. So if my patient could have escaped from the inflammatory bowel disease or the bowel cancer, it will be fine. But you cannot escape from this. This is it. So then they took the mouse, they put him in a cage, closed the door, and gave him the electrical shock. So this time he's alone, and he cannot escape with the same shock. This mouse starts to become ill. He loses his hair, and at some point he develops a peptic ulcer and starts to vomit blood. So if you're alone with all sorts of shocks, you know, you become ill. But it's quite dramatic how it affects the body. I think it goes back to Psalms, even if I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil because you are with me. So we need a companion in the valley of the shadow of death, and people with these illnesses are in the valley of the shadow of death. We all are, but they have more acute reminders of it. And then they take two mice, put both of them in a cage, close the door, give them the same electrical shock. It's poor mice. But this time nothing happens to them because they are not alone. So if you have a second mouse in your cage, you're protected from all sorts of things. But the second mouse needs to be ready to be electrocuted. So I think when we go into the consulting room, if we are not electrocuted, the patient is alone. Actually, suddenly it dawned on me that what people often ask, how do you spend so much time with people with all these problems, and I many times feel that the patient is my second mouse. So I'm not alone. In moments of meeting, actually, because the electrical shocks are not just what happens to the patient, it's what happens in life. So this is very important. I think, and it goes across all theories. But I believe that if somehow we get this right, we can do something very important. And a human demonstration, I think, for me, of the two mice is this amazing picture of Goya, where he painted himself and his doctor. You see at the, at, in the background you see all these shadowy monsters, and so it's Valley of the Shadow of Death, but this is when he was very, very ill, and it's a homage to his doctor. And as you can see, the doctor is a good second mouse. And sometimes, you know, a psychoanalyst in a hospital, a patient asked her for a glass of water, and she said to her, "Sorry, we don't have water here." And the patient actually made the complaint. And I said to her, "Do you know what? I see that you come from your theoretical background and didn't want to gratify her wish or whatever. But I think you're in a hospital, and hospital is about hospitality. And I would give the glass of water, and then you can reflect as much as you want. What does it mean?" But this is a painting of one of my patients that she gave me after we finished the therapy, an eating disorder patient, and she was traumatized by many, many things. So this is the red cut, and she said that she is this green structure here that interestingly looks like a bit like an intestine, and I am this eye with the yellow. So it's even the consciousness, but for me it's a very beautiful picture of this matrix of patient and therapist and all these elements that are together, but also of body and mind. If the eye is the mind, and this is the body. So I'll just go quickly through images of body and mind. This is Jacob fighting the angel, Delacroix painting in Saint-Sulpice Church in Paris. So if the angel represents the mind, see, the body and the mind can sometimes fight. This is Rembrandt, Jacob and the angel. It's a more compassionate holding, in a way that the mind holds the body. This is Avicenna, the Persian alchemist from the 13th century. He was a physician, and he said, if you can see, there is at the bottom there is a little toad, and the little toad is chained to an eagle. So he said, connect the flying eagle to the earthy toad, and you will know our art. So connect these two things. And sometimes, you know, patients want to escape from the earthy toad, and patients said to me, "I wish I could fly away from my pain," but it's impossible. These things are chained together. This is another painting of a patient. Actually, he painted Sarah when she's being announced that she's pregnant. You can see there is a golden egg inside, in this pot of the fruit of her belly. But it brings very, very viscerally the heaven and earth, the mind and the body, and how they are connected. This is another image of a patient of mine that has a connective tissue disorder. It's very, very slim, and cannot eat, has gastroparesis, the gut doesn't work. And I think it's a self-portrait. She now started School of Illustration. I won't go into the whole story, but it was quite remarkable. She was... So I think in a way the paper boat is a fragile body. But there is this fisherman who is in yellow. Yellow is consciousness and humor and optimism. And there is the lake. You know, in German, the lake is See, and Seele is the soul. So the soul is many times connected to the lake. So another image of body and mind. This is another difficult relationship of body and mind. Titian, the slaying of Mercias. Mercias said to Apollo that he can play the lyre better than him, and Apollo, who was perfect in many ways, but his shadow is his, you know, perfectionism and intolerance to any competition. So he takes his skin off, and while the Mercias is being Slade, he plays the lion. So for me, it's an image of sometimes how the mind can be disconnected from the body. And you have many patients that come after years of symptoms and they just ignore them. This is the head of Medusa, you know, the Perseus holds her. Another disconnection between the body and the mind. But the story of Medusa leads me quite into the work with people with gut problems and trauma. Just briefly into the story of Medusa that probably both, most of you know. Medusa was a beautiful woman, monstrous woman with snakes in her hair, that if you would look at her, she will turn you into stone. So you would be petrified. And Petrus is stone in Latin. Interestingly, Medusa herself, this is a detail that I learned not long ago, was a victim of trauma. So Medusa was a beautiful princess, Libyan princess, that served Athena in a temple. And Poseidon, who is the arch enemy of Athena, Athena again is very heady and Poseidon is the sea and the feelings, rapes her in the temple of Athena. And Athena, like it happens many times with victims of rape, blames the victim for seducing Poseidon and tells her, because of this, you will turn into this creature that will turn people into stone. And I think this really embodies the utter loneliness of the traumatized person. In a way, you cannot tell your story because people will turn into stone. So I know from my parents, they told me stories about the Holocaust just when I was 30 because they didn't want to petrify me. So Medusa herself is, it's not just monstrous. This is the image of Medusa after she's being beheaded, of Caravaggio. It's an amazing image of her. But what is also very amazing in this story that from the beheaded body of Medusa emerges Pegasus, the winged horse. Actually, how Perseus beheaded Medusa, because you cannot approach her, Athena gives him her shield and tells him, when you approach Medusa, don't look at her, obviously. Look at her reflection. The reflection is not as powerful as her real gaze. This is actually very beautiful that in English the word reflection is the optical reflection, but also to reflect. And through the reflection, Pegasus is being released, and from the first place where Pegasus touches the ground, the creak of the muses emerges, the creak that gave inspiration to all human creativity. So if you wrap it up, this is the essence of psychotherapy. Through the reflection on our internal monsters, we are able, maybe, if we overcome the petrifying effect of them, to liberate Pegasus. And sometimes, just to bring it back to the power of the psyche, the power of stories, the power of poetry, and we are in the age where, you know, these evidence-based therapies, I met with a new, there is a new manager in St. Mark's who said to me, release all your long-term patients by the end of March, and I want you to see all the patients 6 times. And I want you to give them benchmark questionnaires. You know, this is, I won't go into this now. And the CBT and said, what's the evidence that your service is good? I said, you know, I have my 360 degrees feedback, and 28 patients said that they're highly satisfied, that this is what they wrote. He says, what they wrote is not evidence. He says, why it's not evidence? He says, you cannot quantify it. You know. So, if I would have told him this story, you know, it would get me into more trouble, because one of my patients developed a horrific vomiting phobia. It's called hematophobia. So she has some traits of an autistic spectrum disorder. She's very sensitive. She saw her sister vomiting. She had the norovirus, the sister, and the sister vomited for 24 hours. And the patient was so horrified by this that she became extremely terrified of vomiting. And then she thought to herself, in order not to vomit, I need not to eat. So she stopped eating. She stopped eating and gradually lost weight. And every young woman losing weight is anorexic until proven otherwise. So she was admitted into an eating disorder unit. And nobody believed her that it's just because of the vomiting. And then because she didn't eat, she became very constipated. Because if you don't eat, you cannot. And then she was straining a lot. And because she lost a lot of muscle mass because not eating, so her pelvic floor muscles were very weak, and she strained, she developed a rectal prolapse. So she came to us with a rectal prolapse. Then I realized that she actually has also a serious agoraphobia and a phobia of going out. Interestingly, she works in a nursery with children, and when she works with the children, she's not afraid of vomiting or anything because she's really emotionally engaged. So when you are emotionally engaged, you cannot be anxious. And we had to work with her to overcome the fear, to correct the prolapse, which is now done. But then I discovered that she didn't visit her cousins for nearly 5 years because she's afraid that she will vomit on the way. And she vomits in their house. And I felt telling her the story of Perseus and Pegasus and Medusa, and I said, this vomiting is your Medusa. Obviously you can do all sorts of things, and we think maybe to do some EMDR. But she's now late 20s, but she said, oh, Pegasus, how does it look like? So in Jung's time, we didn't have Google, but you have the Google with you. So I said, okay, let's look at it. And this is the image. And she really fell in love with this. And after 6 weeks, she comes and shows me a photograph of the speedometer of her car. I said, what's that? I said, this is me going to Aylesbury to meet my cousins. And she went to meet her cousins. I said, what happened? I said, I love this image of Pegasus so much, so I put it in front of my bed every night, and I said, you know, I need to fly to them, I need to go to them. Somehow this meditation on Pegasus' image somehow freed something. You know, this is evidence-based, you know. It worked. And again, Pegasus is a very powerful image of, you know, again, body and mind, you know, the wings and a unity of body and mind. This is why actually I quite like to come to St. Mark's, because, you know, the winged lion reminds me of Pegasus. So now a bit about trauma in the gut. This is the tamarind-coated monkey from Colombia. They actually did another cruel experiment, and they took him away and put him in a cage in another country. And this monkey developed ulcerative colitis and colonic cancer. So, and they never ever develop it in the jungle. So it just showed you what loneliness, being trapped, does. Actually, what I meet a lot in St. Mark's, people who come with unexplained gastrointestinal symptoms, I meet people who were gutted by what happened to him, literally, became sick of what happened to him, could not digest or stomach what happened to them, and that their stomach is knotted with fear. Again, the link between emotional agony and the gut is very old, and I recently found this beautiful quote from Psalms that I put on the brochure. I am poured out like water, and my bones are out of joint. My heart melted like wax. It melted in the midst of my bowels. Everything goes into the gut. And this is the statistics. 60% of women with idiopathic gastroparesis. So gastroparesis is a very serious condition where the gut stops to contract. So it just cannot contract. And then people cannot eat, and then they need to be fed through a central venous catheter. And 60% of women with idiopathic gastroparesis reported a history of physical or sexual abuse, and physical abuse was significantly associated with abdominal pain, somatization, depression, and lifetime surgeries. And two quotes, what the mind has forgotten, the body remembers long after. And this is Clarissa Estes, who wrote Running with the Wolves. She writes, the body remembers, the bones remember, the joints remember, even the little finger remembers. Memory is lodged in pictures and feeling in the cells themselves, like sponge filled with water. Anywhere the flesh is pressed, wrong, even touched, lightly, a memory may flow out in a stream. But this is actually what we want to achieve in the body-mind relationship, I believe. Somebody in 2006, quite late in the history of mankind, looked at the creation of Adam in the 16th chapter and looked at the structure God is in and asked himself, actually, what is it? And said, it's a sagittal section of the brain. And after you look at it like that, you will never be able to look at Michelangelo picture differently. And I think Michelangelo meant it. Because actually what Adam receives from God is not life, is not life, he's alive. He received consciousness. And once these two fingers touch, the eagle is connected to the toad. We are doomed or blessed. You know, there is a wonderful poem of Lao Tzu, you know, the Taoist, who says, if the fish would have known that it's a fish, it would drown in a sea. If the goat would have known that it's a goat, it would fall from the cliff. The fish and the goat know themselves in a knowledge that doesn't know itself. But man knows himself in a knowledge that knows itself. This is why he cannot be a fish and a goat. If the salmon fish would have known that he needs to cross the whole ocean, jump over waterfalls, lay his eggs and die, he would say, forget it, I'm not going to do it. So we have the salmon instinct within us, but we have also the knowledge that knows itself. So we need to live with this very unique duality that we have a body, but we are the body. So it's constant, this movement between using the body and reflecting on the body, between being the observer and the participant. And in dissociative states, we're just observers. And when we're just participants, we sometimes find it hard to reflect. So now I want to go really into the clinical part and bring you a story of three patients and actually share with you how the symbolic Jungian approach is really helpful and useful. And I don't need questionnaires for the evidence-based. But for me, it brings back the poetry of the psyche back. So I chose this image, again, body and mind, of his name is he's a Finnish symbolist called Hugo Simberg, and it's called the Wounded Angel. So this is where actually the body needs to carry the wounded mind. So this is sometimes healing bottom up. It's sometimes very powerful. You know, I last 2.5 years I immersed myself in Tai Chi and Qigong, and just doing these things after a long day of work where you feel completely, your psyche feels like this angel. You just start to do these movements and suddenly your wounded angel is carried by the body. But I chose this picture because a patient of mine who came with severe gastroesophageal reflux. So everything goes up. She feels she's going to choke all the time. And it's a long-term syndrome that she was suffering from nearly for 15 years and was highly investigated, doesn't go anywhere. She also was diagnosed with OCD. And she has this ritual that every time she drinks something, she's afraid that somebody spat in the tea. Or in her, so she needs to do another cup of tea, another cup of tea, another cup of tea. So she was referred to the state-of-the-art OCD unit at the Maudsley. They work with exposure and behavioristic exposure. And what they did there is they made her a cup of tea, spat in the tea, and made her drink it. I wouldn't drink such a thing. And obviously it didn't help. So when I found out that she has a history of horrific abuse, obviously you don't want anything to be put in your container, in your cup, in your body. And this is maybe a way to process that, to control what gets into the body. She also had images, intrusive images, of hanged angels and also of stabbed Buddhas. But the hanged angel really caught my mind, because this is the stuff of poetry. You know, if you would start a poem like that, you say, I went out of my house in a nice spring day, and in my neighbor's garden on the tree, there was a hanged angel. That's it. So at this OCD unit, they told her, don't think about it. Or draw it and throw the drawing into the bin. So see, when you understand that this is a symbol, and when I heard the whole story of the abuse, I found myself saying to her, thank God for this image, because this was your way to articulate what happened to you. This image embodies what happened to your angelic part and to your innocence and how it was violated. Also, hanging is this connection between the body and the mind. So all sorts of things happened in the body that the mind cannot contain. So this image creates this disconnection. And we don't need to be afraid of this image. We need to start to understand it, to communicate with it. Now, and these are these moving surprises that you think for that it's worth to you know, suffer all the administrative pain. And now she says to me that the angel became alive, and every time she is in distress, this angel holds her left hand. By the way, the left hand is connected to the right hemisphere, which is the emotional hemisphere. So if we would throw the hanged angel into the bin, we wouldn't have access to the angel becoming alive. So another patient, this is a sculpture of a Maasai woman, a wooden sculpture. And I brought it because this is a patient actually I see now. She became again with refractory IBS. And by the way, two patients agreed that I'll use their material here, but obviously if you can keep it in the room. But they agreed. She came with chronic abdominal pain, IBS, a very severe spasmodic pain. And sometimes these IBS symptoms can be really, really serious and disabling. You say lightly IBS, but it's a whole spectrum. And some people are really caged at home because of it, cannot go out because it's really unpredictable, and you can have diarrhea and constipation and fecal incontinence and all sorts of things, and breaking wind in public, and people become really socially phobic about it. So she has this pain, and she became suicidal. They wanted to take her adolescent daughter away from her social services. It's a whole thing. And then the pain actually sometimes responds to probiotics. You know, probiotics are the good bacteria. By the way, this is a new thing now about body and mind and gut and brain. The gut biome on the bacteria in the gut, you know, we have 100 trillion bacteria in our gut. Actually, there is a book called 10% Human, which actually said that we are 90% bacteria. And these vicious good bacteria connect with the enteric nervous system of the gut. So they actually affect the mind. I recently was asked to review a paper for the Journal of Analytical Psychology. Somebody wrote a paper, the connection between the gut biome, these microbacteria, and the four functions of Jung: thinking, feeling, sensing, and intuition. And the gut bacteria. And I must say, it's quite a fascinating paper. The only problem with it was that you don't need psychotherapy, you just need probiotics and everything will be solved. But it was a very brave trial to try to bring these two things together. Anyhow, so this patient, gradually she came with her companion, she couldn't speak. Gradually she comes on her own. And the first thing you do, again, if you work in the psychosomatic field, one of the mistakes, in my view, is to do this split between the mind and the body. And people hate it, justly, when you say it's in your mind. Because it's not in your mind, it's in your body mind. And because it's one system, it doesn't matter what comes first. You just work with what comes up. So she came to England from Somalia. And it took us really nearly 15 sessions to start to speak about the emotional pain. But it emerged organically. I didn't say to her, maybe this related to this, because once you say it, it's intellectual and you don't experience it. So now she starts to speak about the emotional pain. And she came to England from Somalia. And now, just in the recent months, she told me a lot of things that happened there. So she had a genital, you know, a mutilation. It's part of this ritual, female castration. And her father was a very rich man, but he became rich when she was born. So the father had quite a few women, and he decided he wants to separate from her mother. So he kidnapped her from her mother. He didn't want the mother, but he wanted her because she became his talisman, because he became rich when she was born. So he wanted her near him. So the mother couldn't stand it and abducted her back. So then he went to the mother and abducted her back and took a fresh branch of a tree and beat her for a long period just to make her not go to the mother again. And she was devastated, and she found a sculpture of a Maasai woman which she went with all the time, calling her mommy, mommy. It was when she was 3 or 4. And the father couldn't stand it, so he took the sculpture and put it in a garage and locked it. And she was crying for days in front of this garage. It's one of the things that emerged now. And then she came to England, actually studied media, and studied did this, a film about refugees that won an international prize, but then got involved with a man who was very problematic and abusive and quite narcissistic. They're now separated. He's in the States, and she lives alone, and she developed these symptoms, I think, because the symptom, I think, is the embodiment of her loneliness, of her pain, of her emotional pain. But again, I don't go into an interpretation that this is this, because then just stay with it and try to allow myself to be electrocuted by it. And gradually the emotional links come. But this is where I thank God that I chose the Jungian way. Because I start to ask about dreams, and there is an continuous flow of supportive compensatory dreams. just gifts of reassurance that come again and again and again from the psyche. And for me, this is an evidence-based information that the unconscious, like Jung said, is not just a cage for sexuality and aggression, but part of the self-regulatory, compensatory part of the psyche. So these are just a few dreams. She finds herself singing in an angelic voice, and everybody listens and enjoys her singing. Then she speaks, and suddenly she realizes that she can rhyme and create poetry. Another dream, an attractive man wants to be with me. I tell him that I'm ill, but he doesn't care and hugs me, and it feels good. She constantly condemns herself and calls herself names, and this dream actually tells her, no, you are worth a hug. And you can see it also on the level of relationship with the man, but also relationship with her internal animus and so on. And now, last week, I found special jewels, antique, they are purple, and noticed that there are two elderly, wise-looking men that want to take me to a special place of healing in the mountains in Transylvania. This, you know, this is a woman that sits alone with constant pain, wants to stop the pain, kill herself. Suddenly these things emerge. The phase now in the therapy is to help her to embrace it and to own it. Because she really feels a bit, what is it? And I said my role is to keep these things here because they are precious and they are images for further use. But for me, this is a psychic brain MRI. So this is a proof that there is this potential. So for Jung, the dream is not just a wish, it's a potential. And a few more dreams. A dream that she has a young girl, that is not a daughter, that is very playful and she plays with her again. She is in a room that is very spacious and she doesn't know how she has all this space. Just from today, I had a session today, I had to write a letter to the support living allowance for her because they want to take this payment from her. And while I was typing, you know, and I didn't have much for a session because it was in my room and we typed the letter because these are the things that you have to do sometimes, so it's not pure setting. I couldn't resist asking her if she had another dream. She said, oh yes, I had this dream. I was singing in a car outside, and then there were these men who were looking for the voice that came, and they said, we're looking for this voice. They looked everywhere, and then they came to me, and they asked me to sing, and they said, yes, this is the voice. And come with us. And it reminded her association was for Cinderella. And actually, you know, it looks shabby, but actually there is something precious there. So, and I'm aware of the time, there is another piece that I can go through of another journey of a patient, if you want, or if time allows. I think it's around 15 minutes. So, I don't know how you feel about it, or... Yeah? Yeah? Okay. So, maybe some of you heard it before when I gave this talk in the synagogue, but this is an anorexic patient I worked with in an inpatient unit, eating disorder unit, and I called this presentation Holding in My Left Hand a Pulsating Heart, Reflections on Dreams Emerging During the Analysis of a Young Woman Suffering from Life-Threatening Anorexia Nervosa. You don't see it. Just a second. Okay. Yeah. So, this is just a reminder that in Hebrew, my mother tongue, The word dream is chalom. The word healing is hachlama. So dreaming and healing are related in Hebrew. Also, in one of the ancient books in the Talmud, in Masechet Brachot, I think, there is a part on chalomot, on dreams. And they say, chalom shelo dubar bo hu kmo igeret shelo nikra. A dream that you haven't discussed is like a letter that hasn't been read. So it's actually that the dream is a letter that our psyche writes to us. And obviously we can receive the most moving letters, but put them aside. Like the other patient, she receives all these letters, but I still feel she cannot really embrace it and own it as herself, as part of herself. Interestingly, going back to her, she had the dream that she adopts a girl, and then the following dream was that she has a girl that is her own. So something starts to happen. But this patient, so this is the psychiatric language. So it's the early 20s, a female with a body mass index of 14.5. So the normal body mass index is 20, so she's severely underweight. She has amenorrhea, she doesn't have her period. And she comes with what is called binge purging anorexia nervosa. So anorexia nervosa, binge purging type. So it behaves like bulimia because there are binge eating and vomiting, but it's anorexia because she's underweight. And when you vomit, you lose potassium. You lose hydrochloric acid, you lose hydrogen. The kidneys try to absorb the hydrogen, but in the kidneys, if you absorb hydrogen, you secrete potassium. And potassium is crucial to the electrical activity of the heart. So if you have a low or high potassium, you can end with fatal arrhythmias. And she has suicidal risks, she's self-harming, depressed, anxiety. When she came to us, she was treated with SSRIs. These are the, you know, specific serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the drugs from the Prozac family. And she was admitted under the Mental Health Act to an inpatient eating disorder unit. You know, the numbers that people receive, F50.0, anorexia nervosa purging type, and she received also F60.31, emotionally unstable personality disorder, borderline type. So I don't know what you think about the borderline personality disorder. I personally don't like this name because it's like saying that your personality is disordered. Where actually, in my experience, nearly most people with borderline personality disorder, we're talking actually about complex PTSD. Severe traumas in childhood, incapacity to regulate affect, and all sorts of things that could never happen because there was nobody there that was internalized. So it's basically attachment traumas. But any chaotic behavior, self-harming, you get this label of borderline personality. And the tragedy is that because one of the hallmarks of the borderline personality disorder, when you read the criteria in the DSM, is identity diffusion. You don't know who you are. Then you receive the name borderline personality disorder. So people start to come and say, I'm BPD. And then there are groups for BPDs. So I find comfort in this sentence of Jung from 1937 in his paper, The Realities of Practical Psychotherapy. Actually, I always, you know, for years suffered from this undermining by our psychoanalytic colleagues that actually relate to Jung as a sort of an airy, fairy, mystical, you know, unpractical person, where the Freuds are now the people who are really get into the bottom of it. And actually, when you read Jung, I always find it's very down to earth. And I like this quote. As a rule, diagnosis does not matter much. as the needs and the difficulties of the treatment are related to other factors than problems in diagnostic accuracy. As there are only individual disorders, their course is nearly always atypical. Try to put that on the cover, back cover of the DSM. So, before we go to the patient, I had a patient in an eating disorder unit, outpatient unit, that they wanted me to assess because she's suicidal, she's self-harming, she had a lot of CBT, and I'm not really, I think CBT brought a lot of help, I think, to many people. But interestingly, I learned that actually Aaron Beck, who created the CBT, came from a Jewish family from Lithuania. And in Lithuania, there was a split between the Litvaks, who were very heady and scholars, and the Hasidim, who actually put more pressure on the intention of what you feel when you pray. And it doesn't matter if you read from left to right or if you whistle, but what's important is what you feel. So he came from this heady family. And they found, I think, some documentations that he gave scores to everything he did, Aaron Beck himself, including to something that he called BAM, which is actually being a mensch. So he scored how humane he was during the week. So on Wednesday he was 7.2 humane, on Thursday he was 7.6 humane. So actually, how do you quantify it? 0.4 being humane? And this is actually relevant because a patient of mine that I referred to, another psychologist who does EMDR for trauma, but she's also a fundamentalist of these benchmark questionnaires, the patient came back and said, I don't want to see her anymore. I said, why? Well, she gave me this questionnaire, and in the questionnaire there was this question, from 0 to 10, how much you love your children? As a sort of a way to quantify how you feel in your family. I said, sure. When my son says to me, shut up, it goes to 0. After an hour, he shows me a poem that you wrote, it goes to 10. You know, it changes on an hourly basis. But to quantify love, the most complex feeling of ever, in a number, you know. So this patient, I asked her if she has a dream. And she said to me, yes, I had the dream that I look through a kaleidoscope and I see myself as a baby crawling on ice, shouting, daddy, daddy. And then I, as myself now, go to this baby, hold him, and soothe him. And she said, like the people may say, oh, it's just a stupid dream, I don't know what to do with it. And her mother was very cold, ice, and the father left when she was a baby. So, but the dream actually tells us that she has the capacity to hold and soothe herself. And sometimes people, I believe, need to be told that this is what your psyche tells you, that you have this capacity. I was so moved by this dream that I came to the service manager. I said, I think she'll be all right. I said, what do you base this? I said, look at this dream. She has this capacity. She looked at me a bit perplexed. I said, did you fill the risk assessment questionnaire online? You know, the problem with these risk assessment questionnaires online that you spend so much time to fill them that you don't see the patient, which puts them more in risk, then you need to fill another questionnaire. So, but she says to me this amazing sentence. And again, I'm not throwing the baby off CBT with the water, because whatever gets you through the night, it's all right, if it helps. But she says to me, CBT helps me to organize my thoughts, but it does not help me to know who I am. So, again, with eating disorders, there's a huge link with trauma. So again, this Van der Linden, who wrote this book, Trauma Dissociation, Impulse Discontrol in Eating Disorders, found that 72% of eating disorder patients reported on some sort of trauma, and emotional trauma is probably the most important. Difficult and stressful family situation, parentification, so children that had to look after their parents, confrontation with alcoholic, depressed, or eating disorder parent, poor attachment, lack of parental warmth, death and loss in the family, and so on. Sexual abuse was associated with daily purging, frequently, and self-destructive behavior. Emotional abuse was associated with average daily moods, liability and insecure attachment related to negative body evaluations. So it's the common sense, you know, if nobody hugs you and loves your body, how will you love your body? And if all sorts of things happen to your body, you know, how can you regulate your feelings if you didn't have any companion in the valley of the shadow of death? And then people develop what he calls somatization dissociation. So loss of appetite, vomiting, uncontrolled eating, taste and smell alterations, stomach, intestinal cramps with diarrhea, selective eating. This behavior can serve several functions. Emotional anesthesia, so actually you numb your feelings by concentrating on the eating behaviors, self-punishment, making the body sexually unattractive, a coping mechanism to deal or escape from traumatic memories, and so on. So this is just the theoretical background. And now to the patient. So the patient said to me, this is the patient, the anorectic patient, I have a black poisonous material in my stomach. I need to starve it so it would not contaminate others. And she was worried that I will become ill sitting next to her. Speak about the two mice. I will be electrocuted by this. And if a nurse was absent one day on the ward, she said it's because of my black star. Psychiatrically, she was not psychotic. She didn't represent any signs of schizophrenia or any other mood disorders. Her thought process was correct. Her affect was fine. She was actually looked like a pre-Raphaelite, beautiful, beautiful woman. She was just her red hair. And when I found what happened to her in her life, I got a bit more access to the black stuff. So her father was a really violent alcoholic who used to beat her and her sister quite violently. They didn't know which father opens the door when he comes back drunk. And when she became anorexic, he stopped beating her because she was so frail. So actually the anorexia protected her. So you don't leave something that helps you. Then in the village where they lived, and by the way, she agreed that I used the story as well, long time ago. So they lived in the village, and the father betrayed the mother with the wife of the neighbor, and then the betrayed man found himself with the betrayed mother. So there was this cross, and they just were across the road. So somebody said that confusion is a wrong fusion. So when thinkers are wrongly fused, we are confused. So then the new stepfather, stepman, was sexually inappropriate towards her. And when she was coming out of the bathroom, he used to lie on her. And again, she was not able to move. He didn't perform a sexual act, but this was really, really confusing. So when I heard that, I generally quite go with Winnicott's suggestion to wait and wait and wait until you give an interpretation and try that the interpretation will organically emerge. But in this case, I went quite quickly and I said, I think this is your black stuff. I think the black stuff is all the things that you couldn't speak about and you actually stomached it here. You cannot deal with it, so it's dissociated to the body, and then you try to get rid of it. But like the hanged angel, if we'll get rid of the black stuff, we'll get rid of all the important content that needs to be communicated. And actually, I'll bring some reference to alchemy. We can say that this is the nigredo. And in an old alchemical text, I think I read in one book, they wrote the alchemists, when you meet the black, be happy, because this is where the work starts. So actually it starts with this black. And she didn't want to get to have treatment. I said to her, listen, you're under the Mental Health Act. It's your chance to have a life. We don't want to give up on you so quickly. But pay attention to your dreams, and let's see what they... So she looked at me a bit skeptical, but then... Something that the David Hart, in a chapter in the Cambridge Companion to Jung, a chapter on the classical approach, I found this wonderful term, the practical significance of the unexpected. So I really love it. You know, these things emerge, you know, and you don't know from where, but then they have such a practical impact that it's unbelievable. So this was her first dream. I escaped from the hospital to the sea. The nurses and the doctors, and me among them, are chasing after me. I jump into the muddy water, quicksand. They follow me, jump into the sea, and save me. Then we all stand on the shore, which is very muddy. Now they start to sink in the mud, but this time I help them and pull them out. So you see, this dream, you know, came from nowhere, very unexpected, but it's very practical. Because I actually said to her, I think you want to be treated, you want to be saved. I didn't say to her, the sea is the unconscious, or, you know, so all these things. But actually, if you know the work of James Hillman, he said actually this is part of sometimes the pitfall of the Jungian reductive metaphors, that we say the sea is the unconscious. He says, first of all, leave that. Stay with the sea. Which sea is it? What's the color of the sea? Feel the sea. You know, once you say that it's unconscious, you estrange yourself from the sea. How to keep both in mind? Anyhow, so I said, you want to be saved, but you want maybe that I will start to feel, how does it feel to sink as well? You need me to go into the mud. And if I represent the healing function in you, you want to save the healing function. So your psyche tells you that you want to be saved. And thank God that she became very curious about it, and she became very engaged with this. But see, these are the things that, you know, if you think about the self as the God image within us, so these images are God sent. So then the second dream, and by the way, this dream appears over a period of a year and a half, so it's not very neat like that, you know. It's in the mud of therapy and trying to harm herself and escape and all the... So the second dream, I'm in my parents' house. My father and mother are in the kitchen. I'm hiding in my room, but then decided to go out to the corridor where suddenly I see a huge spider with the letter M is written in red on his back. I'm terrified, but then you, me, appear and say to me, if you are not afraid of spiders, they cannot do anything to you. Actually, it brought all sorts of memories, but also that the father, she was very afraid of spiders as a child, and the father actually used to take the spiders in his hand and put them out. So this alcoholic, abusive father had also another quality of being protective and being gentle with spiders that made it more complex as it is. But also, something in her says, start to reflect, don't be afraid of Medusa, spider, and if you are using the reflective shield, they don't swallow you. And obviously the spider is a very rich metaphor, you know, of the archetypal big mother and so on. The third dream, I see a very small spider on the floor. I know that if a drop of water will fall on it, it will start to grow. I cry and a tear falls on the spider, which becomes enormous. But suddenly somebody appears and slays the spider. This is a very moving dream about the fear to let go of this dissociation. So like, you know, Cat Stevens' song, Moon Shadow, if I won't have my eyes, I won't need to cry no more. Yeah. So she doesn't allow herself to feel. She wants to starve the black star. And if she start to feel, something awful will happen and she will drown in the sea or the spider will take over. But the dream tells her that there is a way to overcome this. I actually used an amplification here, just threw it into the pot. There is a fairy tale that Marie-Louise von Franz uses in the book on fairy tales about the girl who turned into a spider. I'll be just brief, aware of the time. There are two more dreams and we'll end. The story is about a girl who was in love with a man's head. So her father said, this is not on, because the man's head, you know, we won't have children from this. And you know. So he took the head and threw it into the sea. So the desperate girl jumped after the head, and then she found herself on the moon, as you do, and it's beautiful there. And she looks at the whole blue universe, and she doesn't want to go down, and she's fascinated by this. But then on the moon, there is a wise old woman with a spindle that comes to her and says, my dear girl, a moon is not a place for young girls. You need to go down to Earth. And she says, how will I go down? She says, you see, you have this spindle. It looks very delicate, but actually it's very, very strong. So hold it with your two hands, close your eyes, because the descent is very frightening. But when your two legs touch the ground, open your eyes. So the girl takes it, the woman takes it down. Her eyes are closed, but when she touches the ground with two legs, she refuses to open her eyes. And then she turns into a spider. You know. What happens symbolically, that she refuses to be conscious of her earthy part. And this is what happens in anorexia. They are in love with the head. Some anorexic patients tell you, I don't want this body anymore. And you need to help them to be conscious of their body. And then there won't be a spider, you know. So I threw it into the pot and we did some work with this. Then the fourth dream, I'm on a journey with another patient from the ward. The patient had the same name as my patient and was 35 years older than her. It was a ballet dancer that have lifelong anorexia. We are climbing a steep mountain, walking up the stream of a stormy river. She collapses and drowns. I somehow manage to hold on. I come back to my room at the hospital and open birthday presents. So you can say that the sick part, old part, needs to die. She needs to separate from this chronic anorexia. And there is something about opening birthday presents, which is a very palpable symbol of renewal. And then two more dreams. This dream, actually, I was so moved by it, I couldn't really speak. I was speechless. And I'm walking in the wood. It feels like spring. The sun is shining. I'm wearing a white dress and hold in my hand a white lily. I'm walking barefoot on the ground. I reach a little river. I'm standing in the middle of it. It is not too deep or cold. I'm facing the stream. I notice a glass paperweight in the water. I pick it up and suddenly I feel a sharp pain in my chest. I look at my dress and on my chest there is a large reddy bloody spot. I look at my left hand and see that the glass paperweight has cracked and that I'm holding in my hand a pulsating heart. So we don't have time to go into the rich symbolism of it, but you can feel that something, the heart, speak about also the arrhythmias and the life started, and the glass that is actually the dissociation cracked, and it's all soaked with life. I put the white and the red here because it leads to alchemy, to the albedo, to the rubedo. And then, actually, the last dream, I didn't bring it here, finish with this. The last dream is she stands near the sea. She wears a green dress with a white collar. A wave comes and she allows the waves to take her. So this is, if you think about the initial dream, so afraid of the sea. Now there is a a readiness to let go and be in touch with the self. So the ego axis is, ego self axis is much better. Then she finds herself on an island, and in the island there is a house, and she goes into the house. In the middle of the house there is a bed. She lies on the bed, and then there are six surgeons that come. They put a big syringe in her stomach, and they take the black stuff out, and it feels very good. I presented it, and there was a Freudian in the room who looked at me, and with a little smirk, he said, "Don't you think this syringe is her erotic transference to you?" I said, "You know, the difference between a penis and a syringe is that the syringe can take things out." That's right. But this is, you know, the whole thing of the Jungian work, that we don't translate it to something else. It's what it is. But the black stuff comes out, and she's now a nurse, actually. She recovered, and she wanted to be a nurse treating cancer patients. So, this is the albedo, the rubedo, the nigredo. Yeah, and this is actually the last dream with the black stuff coming up. So thank you so much for the generosity with the time and allowing me to speak so much. And thank you very much.
Because we're running a wee bit late, if anyone has got just one or two questions they'd like to ask Dr. Inspector, because we've worked a long day, so we don't have to keep him too much longer. If anyone's got a burning question they'd like to share, perhaps, yeah, go on.
So, what about Jung's vision of the God in the throne above the Basel Cathedral, and he is resisting for quite a long time to that come into his imagination, what's going to happen then?
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful example that then, following that, God actually releases a huge, how do you say, a turd on the church. And as far as I remember, I think what Jung makes with it, that is actually his wish to have a living God, so, you know, a God that actually shits, and it's not just airy fairy. So I think it's a beautiful connection of the, you know, heaven and earth. You can obviously interpret it as you know, his father complex with the church, but it's actually a wish for a living God, which, interestingly, now I'm thinking, goes hand in hand with the Asher Yatzar.
Can I say, yeah, something? In the prayer book that we use every Saturday in Simgol, they've taken the Asher Yatzar, which is about having orifices and need to function. They've taken it out of the home and brought it into the Simgol. And some of the rather more venerable members complained, "We don't want to think about shit in the Simgol." Actually, that's precisely what they ought to be doing. Got final question. Anyone got a final thought or a question? Such a lot of rich imagery to think about. What I'm going to suggest, and I think Caroline was probably going to say the same thing, is stay and have a glass of wine and chat over a glass of wine. Thank you again so much.
Thank you very much.